are listening to a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To subscribe to this podcast, visit questformeaning.org or search for Church of the Larger Fellowship in the iTunes Store.
Hi, this is Meg Riley, and you've joined us for another episode of The View. I'm here in Below Zero, Minnesota, where we have just hosted the Super Bowl in Minneapolis. I think we're all really grateful that it's gone, and so is the huge police force that was here with it. And just a hats off to the amazing activists here who protested all kinds of things and all of the resources that went there instead of to living wage, to justice, to all kinds of things, including three ministers, two UUs who were arrested as part of one of the protests around Black Lives. So hats off to you. Michael Tino, hello.
Good morning, everyone. This is Michael Tino joining you from sunny Peekskill, New York. We're digging out from a little bit of snow yesterday, and nothing like anything you have in Minnesota, though. Hey, good morning, Aisha.
Hi, I'm Aisha Hauser in gray Seattle. That will shock no one. It's maybe in the 50s. I'm not sure. Our winter kind of, we had snow, though, maybe an inch or two, and everything stops. So what are you going to do? Not today. Today's just gray. Good to see you all. Christina.
Hi, I'm Christina Rivera, and I'm joining you from Charlottesville, Virginia, where our winter has been part winter, part spring, part summer. It's been very odd, but there's no climate change, folks, so it's okay. And we've had snow days that the kids have just been really frustrated with because they haven't really been snow days. They've been kind of like, oh, we think it's going to be icy and cold, so we're calling it for school. So we're all really looking forward to spring, which means we will absolutely get a lot of snow here in just a couple of weeks. And Jessica
Star Rocker's doing tech and hanging around today. Yeah, Seattle. It is exactly as Aisha said. It is. It is gray and 50, and it will be that way for months.
We've asked Jessica to stay with us today. You can tell we don't have an unusual guest. It's all of us. We've been kind of here and there, and we're all back together today. So we're excited about that, and we thought we'd do what we're calling a roundup. You can throw a few extra U's in there wherever you'd like. But yeah, just as Michael says, the unusual hosts. And you know, we just thought we'd talk about what's kind of been going on because so many things have been. So Jessica's going to stay out from behind the chalice as well as trying to do tech duty. So you can watch her struggle from time to time with all of that.
And I'll be at hashtag The View on Twitter. I'm taking questions. And also trying to pay attention. So I'll do all the things today.
So it's a great day for people who are listening or viewing live to join in with what you're thinking about. We have some stuff that we've been thinking about ourselves. And I'll start with having just been to the memorial service for Denny Davidoff, which took place on Saturday in Westport, Connecticut. Her sons, Doug and John, put a lot of work into it. And Olivia Holmes, Reverend Olivia Holmes, really kind of was the overarching host. It was well attended. It was wonderful to see many people who were there, including all of the moderators since Denny Davidoff. Well, no, that's wrong. Diane Olson was not there, but Jenny Von Corder was there, and Barb Grieve and Alondria Williams were there. Susan Frederick Gray was there, and all kinds of people who love Denny, not just from Unitarian Universalism, but from Westport. Her grandsons, 3 out of 4 of her grandchildren, all of the grandsons did spoke about her. That was very poignant. They told personal stories. We got to meet Mr. Softy, the stuffed animal who kept her company in her last days, which was a little monkey, which was very sweet. It was poignant. And I have to say, truthfully, I still don't believe she's dead. Like, I went partly because I can't believe she's dead. And I thought maybe, you know, and it was a 2.5 hour service. So I had plenty of occasion to believe it, but I still cannot believe that she's dead. And I think sometimes for those of us who saw her infrequently, you know, maybe at GA I'll start to believe it. But she felt so strongly in the room. It felt so much like an event she would have loved herself and did, I'm sure, wherever she is, love. But, you know, her son said there was a lunch beforehand for family and close people, which I'm honored to say I was invited to. And her son said it's wonderful to have all the parts of her life together in a room for us, you know. And they talked about the difficulty of being family to somebody who is so claimed by, you know, a wider circle that, you know, of course, they're in the deep, deep grief that you are when somebody who's, you know, the center of your life is gone. And so many thousands of us are feeling her loss. So I was really grateful that they shared their mother with and their grandmother and their, you know, she was 84, I think. And, you know, I think we all thought she was going so strong when I last saw her at GA that I would have given her another 10, 20 years, you know. So, but it was very moving. All the people, the word mentor came up over and over and over and over again. And I think that is who she's been to so many folks. Leon Spencer spoke about her work against white supremacy. And apparently, according to several family members, when she was literally on her deathbed, I mean, she was, you know, in hospice, she was grilling them all about white supremacy and talking about the hospital and white supremacy in the hospital. And, you know, she was herself to the very last minute. And it was wonderful to honor her and to be with so many people who loved her. And I'm still taking it in that she's not walking around on the planet. I know she's here somewhere, but I remember when my kid was 3 and I was leaving town and I said, but I'll be in your heart. And Jai said, but my heart can't smell you or hold your hand, you know. And that I feel is that what grief really means is that we can't. I wished that they had played her voice. You know, she had such a distinctive voice. And I need to go online and just listen to her talk because, you know, I can hear a lot of dead people right in my ear still. And I need to hear her voice and remember it more. So I'm sure everybody has Denny stories to tell, anyone who ever interacted with her at all, right up to people like Jessica, who are students now at Meadville.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, we talked about Denny a little bit right after she passed away. And she and I had kind of a shtick going on for about the last 10 years that we would remind each other that it takes courage to say the things that are unpopular that need to be said, such as, you know, the white supremacy in the hospital around me. I mean, that is so Denny. And, you know, I was unable to be at the service, which is upsetting, though it's still actually available online, I understand. But I did see the order of service from it the next day, and it struck me how her family, in that order of service, the first thing that they wrote in their note in the order of service was how hard it was to share Denny with their mother, their grandmother, with Unitarian Universalism, about which she was so passionate. And to see that, like, this thing that she was so passionate about was outside of the family. And that, I think, is powerful. It was powerful to read that. And I hope that they have support in their grief.
Yeah, yeah. She, clearly her family was the center of her life, as it is for any of us. And she was so active, you know, she was just... And hearing about her, I happened to eat the lunch across from a friend of hers when she was a teenager, who said, yeah, she was like that as a teenager, which I could hardly just even imagine Denny as a teenager and the energy that would have come from that, you know. But yeah. And I think Jessica's going to put up the link into the Facebook group of where the recording is. It was, you know, it was 2.5 hours long. There were 11 eulogists and a sermon. So, and you know, I thought she deserved every minute of it, but I was proud because I looked at the order of service and said, that's 2.5 hours. And other people were saying, no, that's shorter, that's longer. So it came in at 2 hours and 27 minutes. And I was like, nailed it. So, you know, and it didn't feel, I mean, sometimes things that long, you're like, oh my God, but it was a really interesting, there were so many perspectives. You know, Abhimanyu Jhanamanchi spoke about, you know, being a young person in a college near her and what all that meant. And people were very real about it. It was interesting. I did note, and I just have to say, there were only 2 women of the 11, and they stuck to the time they were assigned, which was like 4 minutes. and I believe Abhimanyu probably also did. And it kind of appeared to me that, and you know, I'm not speaking ill of anyone, but it kind of appeared to me that all of the other men just kind of spoke as long as they wanted to. And I just thought that was notable. I didn't feel like anyone was self-indulgent or went on too long, but I just thought it's just interesting how women follow rules, you know? So anyway, well, what else we got going on? We got the moderator search. Michael, what? We saw that in the world and...
Well, and I think that talking about Denny and her passion for Unitarian Universalism leads really well into the news that we have just seen in the UU world reported from the board. And Christina, you can say more about the board's response, that the moderator search committee did not identify any qualified candidates to stand for election for moderator next year. And that there, you know, there will be a special election for the last year of Jim Key's unexpired term this year, and there's a plan for that. But anyone running for the next 6-year term will have to run by petition, and it's in stark contrast to my experience on the Presidential Search Committee, where we had many qualified candidates. We didn't get them all to apply for the job, right? So we had enough people applying for the job that we felt comfortable that we had identified strong people to serve for election who could all do the job well. And you know, but there were many people that that we talked to who were considering running who would have been very qualified for it. And you know, part of what we have to deal with is that the presidency is a paid position, and the moderator for now, and there might be forthcoming news about that in the next couple months, but the moderator for now is unpaid. And part of that is because Massachusetts state law makes it very difficult to pay the chief governance officer of a nonprofit. Not impossible, but very, very difficult. And 6 years ago, when I was on the board and we were nominating moderator candidates, we wanted to institute a salary for the moderator to attract the most qualified candidates. And we were told by legal counsel that the hurdle for getting approval from the Commonwealth of Massachusetts was so high that we should just not do it. And at the time, he felt very strongly about that, and we didn't want to push it. And there were people who were coming forth who were qualified even with the lack of a salary, which, you know, I mean, we can talk about what it means to be able to devote that much time to a position. I mean, it's basically a full-time job. So what does it mean to be able to have a full-time job and not get paid for it?
I just want to clarify, it's not that they didn't find candidates, it's that they didn't find people weren't willing to put in that time for free. So it's not that there weren't qualified people in the ether, it's that none weren't willing to. That's at least the statement that I understood from the statement, is that people weren't willing to put that time in for free.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, we could probably make a list of people who would do the job very well. Like each of us probably, you know, those of us who are well connected in Unitarian Universalism can come up with half a dozen people who could do that job really well, and they're not folks who can do the job for free, which, you know, it says something about, you know, what we expect, you know, class-wise and from our leadership. It says something sad about that. So, Christina, do you want to say a little bit about what the board's response was? And then you can...
Sure. I serve on the board. I'm a trustee. I'm also secretary of the association, which means I'm responsible for coordinating. Moderator Search Committee did talk to quite a few people, many of whom were qualified. And it really came down to, you can read the statement for yourself, the fact that the moderator position as it's currently structured is time-consuming. There's currently, although the board found a way around this, there's currently not a structured way to do the bylaw structured way to do shared ministry, shared leadership in the position, and it's uncompensated. And so folks were just, basically at this point unwilling to take it on as it's currently structured. So, and like I said, they talked with lots and lots and lots of different people who would be qualified to do the position. And so that was a really strong, we heard that and we really appreciated the work that the moderator search committee did because they put a lot of time and effort into it. They were meeting weekly. They were just, trying to come at it from a lot of different directions to figure out how they could be of service to the association in terms of if it was in fact something where they were going to come back without a candidate or candidates, what did that mean and how could they give us feedback as to what needs to happen? So I know the board is very appreciative of all the work that they went into on behalf of the association, because it really does come down to, some of that, like we're saying, uncompensated time. And if we want to broaden the pool of folks that are willing and able to do the position, then we need to look at the ways in which we are just almost automatically self-selecting, folks out of the position. And certainly the unpaid aspect of it, the time, some of the travel, some of, everything the package currently looks like, really makes it challenging for folks who, don't have a lot of, resources or autonomy over their schedules. So we're excited to see, what this is going to bring, where it's going to lead us. And, we saw what having the tri-presidents looked like. We saw currently what the co-moderators look like. We saw what having the tri-mods at GA look like. And all of that is giving us lots of information as to, trying to think outside of the box and what can we change and what will it look like, and getting feedback from people who are willing to do it in a different way. And how do we move governance forward in a way that serves the association in a new time? So, the moderator position was created at a very different time. And so what does that look like now? So I actually think it's pretty exciting that they didn't come back with a nominee or nominees, because I think it really gives us a lot of opportunity to dive into it and see what could be. And that can cause some anxiety, right? Like anytime you try and change something that's in the system, that can definitely could produce anxiety. But I think it's also I think it's challenging and exciting and gives us an opportunity to really look at new things. So we're already doing it. We're already doing it with the co-moderators, and they're working through, what that looks like for them. And we saw what the tri-presidents look like. with all of those decisions, the board didn't hear a lot from folks that this was a terrible idea or how could we be doing this. Overwhelmingly, the feedback that we got from folks was, great. We are so excited to see this. We are so excited to see shared ministry, shared leadership. We're so, you know, thankful that the board didn't, you know, go down these paths that had already been well trod and tried something different. So I think, you know, we're trying to lead, but we're also trying to listen. So I'm
just curious about the bylaws and the fact that we've already had presidents and now we have moderators. I mean, technically, I know one person was the president. Technically, one person is the moderator, but we're doing something really different than the bylaws. And I think it's great. Years ago, back when I thought I might run for president, I only would have run for co-president, and people said, no, you can't, it's not in the bylaws. And I went, well, then never mind. It's a crazy job for one person to try to do all that, you know? Congratulations, Susan Frederick Gray, you just keep trying. But, you know, it's just, it demands such a wide range of skills, and people can be really good at one part and not at another. So I think it's really exciting, but I wonder, so you're not getting pushback about being out of sync with bylaws. Nobody's getting upset about that.
You know, I think, Meg, what you said is very true. So we did follow the bylaws in terms of the very technical aspects of the bylaws. We did appoint a moderator to fulfill that need. We will elect a moderator, although in effect we are, in my view, electing, you know, both of them because they will both continue to serve. But, you know, so I think if we hadn't taken those steps, folks might have had something to say about that. But, you know, I think when we're looking at white supremacy, we have to acknowledge that the systems and that we've set up are doing exactly what they've been set up to do, right? And so unless we're willing to challenge those systems, they're just going to take us to the places that they were set up to take us. So, you know, in terms of the tri-presidents and the co-moderators, we really haven't. We've heard folks that were very happy that we did what we needed to do to follow the bylaws. And we're very happy that we found a way to do it differently as well. Like it wasn't an either or, it was a both and. So now comes the changing of the bylaws in order to give us that flexibility to do that more nimbly, you know, and that's going to take some time. And I think that's when we'll really see probably, you know, some resistance of the system trying to change, which is to be expected and to be embraced. Like, that's why we do the work that we do. And I also say that without my board hat on, that, you know, I think it speaks to our congregations, right? So our larger congregations or our congregations, even our smaller congregations, we ask our ordained clergy to be a lot of things, right? We ask them to be prophetic leaders, and we ask them to be administrators, and we ask them to be supervisors, and we ask them to know everything that there is to know about how to head personnel and how to change out a light bulb. And so, you know, it's not just in our governance and in our administration of the UUA, it's in our congregations as well that we need to be examining, you know, what are the systems that we have set up that are leading us exactly and doing exactly what we set them up to do. So I don't think it's just, you know, at the board level or at the association level. I think it should be at the congregational level as well, because that's really where the change needs to happen as well.
Christina, can I ask a question? Just as somebody who is, you know, heading down that path of potential ordained clergy, and just I'm, you know, so impressed by how the board seems to be able to enter into the soup of the unknowing and the, you know, I don't know what the, you know, just that messiness and embrace that and just sort of wait and like see what arises, you know, and then sort of go with that. And that's such a, so unusual. And I think it's so challenging when you're part of a, such a larger system that's not built to do that and not, that's not what anybody feels comfortable with. I mean, we can go into like the idea of discomfort, right? And be comfortable with discomfort or whatever. But I don't know. I guess I'm just curious if the board has any practices, like spiritual or otherwise, or you personally, just, you know, of how to hold that and just be cool about it. Because you look really cool when you're talking about it.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, it's hard. So the board struggled. We really struggled with the naming of the tri-presidents. And I think we've been open about that, that that was, that was a big leap forward for us. And leap forward, bad ableist language, sorry, right there. That was a big shift for us. But I think what was central to that is that we named it, right? We named that we were uncomfortable. We named that this was making us all kinds of really nervous and anxiety, and then tried to name what that anxiety was. Was it the fear of not being perfect? Was it the fear of not making a good decision? Was it the fear of failing? And I have to also name that, that, you know, it was folks on the board, namely the POC that were on the board, that have a facility with shared power structures and collaboration that were able to articulate that in ways that folks who weren't as comfortable with that were able to maybe not understand, or it hadn't been their lived experience, but they were able to honor the lived experience that other people were trying to bring to the table. And so I think that naming of it is super, super important, because without that, you're just trying to, you know, you're just trying to feel like you're not drowning. And it isn't until you're like, oh, that's right, we're actually trying to do something different, and here's why it feels so uncomfortable, right? Like naming that we're feeling really uncomfortable right now is half the battle.
I think one of the things that I really appreciated with the response of the board in naming the co-presidents is modeling that leadership. So I've had ministers say to me directly, well, somebody needs to be in charge. And there's this knee-jerk fear of, and because even POC ministers ordained have a lot invested in the system the way it is. So I actually had a POC minister say to me, well, I wouldn't feel comfortable in shared ministry with someone I didn't know. And I was so taken aback. And I said, the minister I work with now, we're in a collaborative leadership model. I didn't know her from a hole in the wall. And I said, this is what I directly said to this person. I said, we have strangers coming in our doors. We're asking them to be part of a covenantal faith and be part of shared ministry as part of being Unitarian Universalism. Are you trying to tell me that we don't have leaders capable of modeling that? So the two things I have now been saying, and I said it to the executive director of the UUMA, Melissa Carville-Zimmer, I said, the two things that I deeply feel need to happen to, along with what the board, the goals and how the board is creating the shift is, to me, the ministerial formation process, which you're going through right now, Jessica, really needs a fundamental shift. And how we do leadership in our congregations, and, you know, really kind of almost refocus the investment in really what is a patriarchal white supremacist culture within the UUA. And it's angered a lot of people. You know, Christina and I and Kenny Wiley, who's here in Seattle, have really tried to say, we're not calling anyone white supremacists. It's about saying we are a part of this culture, and how do we, and unless we name it, we can't change it. And it is uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable for all of us. This is uncomfortable. This is not a joyride for me. So, anyway, yeah.
Yeah. I really appreciate you, Jessica, that you lift that up as somebody who's going through the formation process, because, I work at the congregation in Charlottesville, and we have a senior staff model where the religious educator, myself as the director of administration and finance, and the lead minister all report to the board. We do not report to the lead minister. We're all co-equal, and we have a shared ministry here, which means that we are hyper-focused on accountability between the three of us, because we have to share that. And it's different. And we get that all the time. Well, who does the buck stop with, right? If it's the three of you and it's not the lead minister, who does the buck stop with? And it gives the opportunity to come back and say, well, you know, the buck really stops with the congregation. Like, if we're in shared ministry, we are all in this together. And so why are we looking for one person to, you know, try and be all things to all people? It's just, it's not, it's not a structure of today's time, I would say. You know, it's a structure that, that in my opinion, is better left behind. So what does that look like? You're right. You know, what does that look like going forward? And that's scary for anybody, you know, white POC, who's in these power structures, you know, I never tell anybody, it's not easy. You know, we struggle with it here at our congregation, but as we live into it, we see everything that it brings to us, right? And everything that, that our senior staff is able to bring in their fullness now to the position and to the congregation that if we were just in our little silos, we wouldn't be able to bring. So, but it's hard. So thanks. Thanks for asking the question.
Well, and I think that sort of model too, I mean, to me, it feels so soul filling that, you know, when we think about why people are or are not coming to our congregations, right? Like that model of where everybody is sharing in it and everybody gets to be a part of that conversation in that larger way. And things are talked about, like we don't have to hide secrets and things, like we get to say how we're feeling. Like those are the places I think that people want to come and show up and be a part of that community, you know?
It's a much more transparent model. You hit the nail on the head, Jessica. One of the things we're finding in this congregation where I am, we also have the same model as Christina. There's also a lot of pushback. Christine, there's a lot of pushback to it by folks who are comfortable with who's in charge. It's almost like somebody needs to get in trouble when we're unhappy. It really feeds into the dominant paradigm, which hasn't served humanity. It's corporate model. We can list 100 things right now in the next 30 seconds of how it has really damaged humanity and our planet. So I'm not clear why Unitarian Universalism wants to hold on to this paradigm, because it's comfortable. It's what we know. We can go right into discomfort.
We can. And I would lift up, Aisha. So like, you know, people never have a question about the shared ministry model when they want to congratulate somebody, right? When they want to say that we have done a good job, they never have a problem finding me or the lead minister or the religious educator or the rest of the staff. They know exactly how to tell us that we have done something good or something great's going on at church or, you know, or any of those things. It's never that. It's only when their conflict arises. And somebody wants to know, how can I go to somebody who will resolve this conflict for me? And that's when it's hard, because we say, you know, we're not going to resolve that conflict for you. We're going to invite you in to resolving that conflict together, right? And that's sometimes a bummer for people, because they wanted somebody to resolve it and just be like, it's done. So yeah, cause you know, it's uncomfortable, which like you said, leads us into the next topic.
Well, before we move into the next topic, which we did all want to talk about discomfort and courage and emotional honesty, I just want to take a moment to thank the two current co-moderators who are not being paid for their work and who are putting in as are all of the board members and the financial advisor and many volunteers putting in so many hours of unpaid labor, but especially to Barb and to Alondria, huge thanks for work so well done and so faithful. And as we're saying, so exciting for the rest of us. Yeah, and emotional labor, exactly. So yeah, so just take a moment to thank you. And then we did want to spend some time, and Aisha, I'm going to hand this one off to you to start, because we're talking about courageous conversations, and
so
that's a slogan, but you know what I mean.
So there's a TED Talk that I recently viewed that was presented in November 2017 by a South African psychologist named Susan David. So what she talks about is emotional courage. And the fact that we've now labeled emotions as good or bad. And so one of the things she talks about is the tyranny of positivity, that we immediately go to think positive, and somehow feeling bad is somehow or having an emotion that is absolutely appropriate to whatever the situation is that may not be a positive emotion, she said now has been labeled good or bad. And I think for me, one of the aha moments that occurred, I mean, I had already been saying this all along, that folks are, you know, simply uncomfortable with the words white supremacy culture and don't want to use it. Like, I'm not a white supremacist, and it also, you know, then we can avoid doing the work. But the larger picture is, I don't think Unitarian Universalism has done a good job in general since 61. This isn't about any one congregation or any one person, just as a faith community, of teaching us, our folks, to sit in discomfort and to work through it. The healthiest way out of a conflict is through it and learning how to talk to each other, right? So I found a new book, Honest, Direct, and Respectful by Dennis Adams. I highly recommend it. You could read it in about half an hour. He didn't overthink this book, which I super appreciate. And it basically it is a guide of how to have a difficult conversation without avoiding what it is you want to say. Because we think we're having difficult conversations, but they turn into shouting matches. They blame, shame, point fingers rather than work through, and folks take responsibility. The name of the book is Honest, Direct, and Respectful: Three Simple Words That Will Change Your Life Conversation. So
Jessica will be putting that up in the Facebook group.
Great. Yeah. I just think, you know, one of the things that it's important for us to do as a faith right now, part of the paradigm shift, because Christine alluded to this and we've talked about this before, is helping people work through difficulty and really pain. I get it. We're in pain. I mean, those of us we all have feel pain, and what does it look like to work through it without hiding it. So, and I wrote a note about it on Facebook, because I was so inspired by this TED Talk. I like TED Talks in general, but this one was just something. She said, we're in living right now in a denial. Humanity's in denial. She said, we're watching the polar ice caps melt, and we're in denial about the significance of that. So you all jump in.
You know, we treat sadness and anger as like things that you can't touch, right? So, you know, and we tell our kids, you know, like, and maybe now we tell our kids, children are taught that, you know, they shouldn't be sad or they shouldn't be angry. Instead of, it's natural to be angry, and here's a healthy way to deal with that anger. And it's natural to be sad, and here's a healthy way to deal with that sadness. And I think, you know, I deal with that as a parent of a 4-year-old. I'm constantly thinking about, like, what are the messages that she's getting? Because, you know, she's 4 and a half, and I can tell the messages that she's getting. And, you know, we talk with her about, like, okay, are you feeling frustrated? Okay, tell me why you're feeling frustrated, and tell me about what's making you frustrated. Not, oh, you shouldn't feel frustrated, which is the message that she's getting from so many other places. And it's so much healthier for her when she can just feel what she's feeling and not be overwhelmed by the feeling or be guilty that she's sad or angry or frustrated or things. And you know, it's interesting. Not to dominate the conversation, but in the congregation I serve, we're trying very hard to think about what it means to, you know, like many congregations are doing, to really be a place for faith development for our people. And so the religious educator that I work with and I are engaging in conversations and having the congregation engage in conversations about what it is they need for their own faith development. And this Sunday, we had small group conversations over lunch after worship. And one of the members of the congregation in my small group said, I need a place to be able to bring difficult emotions and feel them. Where if something in this world is making me mad, like I don't need to have come to a place where everyone makes me feel better. I need to come to a place where I can be mad about what's happening in the world and, you know, like curse or, you know, whatever. We're New Yorkers here, right? So like we go right to the cursing, as you know, Aisha, being a New Jersey. Or whatever it is that I need to do to feel that anger and figure out what the productive way to deal with that is. And, you know, and she said, I'm like, what might it mean if our congregations are a place where, like, when we're sad, we can come and be sad and, you know, have the congregation surround us and hold us, but not tell us, oh, fuck up. You know, oh, you'll get through this, you know. You know, this was a conversation I had on Sunday. So it's very timely that you bring this up, and thank you.
It's damaging, the secret, and you could wish good things in your life. So it's damaging is what it is. Susan David calls it the tyranny of positivity. And I was like, wow, that is well said.
Well, yeah. And the extreme is, you know, if you have cancer, it's because you're negative. And, you know, there are teachers who are saying that, and it is such an abuse of spiritual power to say that to people and all kinds of other things that are horrific. You know, I was thinking, I go on meditation retreats annually, and when you're on them, you are uncomfortable. I am physically, I'm bored. I'm just having to deal with my own mind. The huge majority of the day, it's on me. And I think one of the things about that is that I am so much more compassionate and kind to everybody else because I see how deeply imperfect I am and how it's a miracle that really I get dressed every day and walk around because I am so absent so much of the time when I'm paying attention. I'm just like, gosh, people build bridges and it works. That's amazing if everybody's as spaced out as I am. But we don't have that kind of spiritual practice that really puts people back on themselves. I mean, if there's 3 minutes of silence in a UU service, people start squirming around. And so, you know, what are the spiritual practices that really develop comfort and also self-reflection about discomfort? I mean, this goes back to the conversation about leadership and how a leader should be able to take care of something if we don't like it, you know? Well, you know, if you're sitting there meditating, you know that there's no one who can take care of what's going on inside of you because it's your own mess, you know? And so how do we, that's just something that I've been really sitting with ever since I started doing meditation about 20 years ago. Like how do we bring that kind of spiritual practice that's authentic for us, you know, into our congregational life as well as these practices of communication, which are central to our covenantal relationship. But, you know, what does that authentically look like for us? I think it's a really interesting question.
Well, and I have heard Christina do this, and it's something that I always remember and go back to, that idea of rejoicing, like when people are having hard feelings, like those negative, you know, quote unquote negative feelings are the point of growth, right? That's when you know you're at a place where something like cool could happen, something exciting. And so you could sit there for a little bit, you might learn something. So, you know, when my son comes to me and says that he's feeling bad about something, it's like, okay, so good. Let's, let's talk about that. There's something there. Let's see what that is. Like, this is exciting. There's a thing. Let's work on it, you know?
Definitely, Jessica. I mean, I think that's the crux of it is that particularly in Unitarian Universalism, we are so conflict avoidant, right? That it is, I mean, like, we say this all the time. We're so conflict avoidant, like just saying it is going to make it better. And naming it, sure, is really important. But being excited about the possibility, you know, being excited about that means something. I mean, when we're doing racial justice work, I tell people, you know, if you don't have, you know, a pit in your stomach, you're probably not doing it right. And so when you do get that pit in your stomach, like, celebrate, rejoice, you're doing it. Like this, you're, like you just said, you're doing the thing. And so to, you know, try and reframe folks to the joy that we can get as a spiritual community, like, you know, like Meg was saying, during service and not just dropping people into that 3 minutes of silence. Like, you know, we have an obligation with faith development to lead people into knowing how to pray and knowing how to be in touch with the divine, however they manifest that in their lives. And so not just we're going to take 3 minutes of silence, but, you know, maybe we take 5 minutes of silence and the first two minister can actually lead us in a prayer. And what that feels like to model how one way of addressing the divine. It's not going to be the way for everybody, but instead of being so scared of being in conflict with those congregants that are going to come up to you afterwards and say, how could you bring the word God into a service, of saying, that's how we know we're doing something together, is because we did get to that uncomfortable place together.
I've had the fascinating experience of when we do a meditation and it's not funny, but there's, you know, a toddler making noise. I've had people complain to me, well, it was distracting. And I want to say, well, then you're not meditating, because you're not supposed to focus on, we should be happy that there are toddlers in here and babies, that our families are wanting to sit in here. But we even have a right to comfort in meditation, where it needs to be completely silent. And if I hear anything, I'm going to go complain to the DRE because I keep wanting to welcome families. So we just, I think I want to kind of reframe a little bit that the learning, I mean, yes, there's ultimately we're heading to kind of a joy of an epiphany, and getting there is painful. It is painful to be disappointed by people that I care about, that there are people committed to misunderstanding me and people who I thought weren't, right? So when we get disappointed, and the most painful thing for me in the past 7 months is to realize, I don't have as many allies as I thought I did. And especially people, I think the most for me, and I'm just going to talk about my own discomfort. When I have colleagues of color who are ordained, who have themselves invested into this system, and really, and there's nothing I can do about that. And I'm like, okay, this is uncomfortable for me that we're not all on the same page. And I have to deal with that. That's life, right? Is what I am not going to change. I mean, obviously me singular is not going to do anything, but working through my own disappointment of a lot of things, and I think heading towards, but then I, you know, there are people who say, wow, you're helping open the, you too, Christine. I mean, all of us who understand that there needs to be a fundamental paradigm shift. Somebody walked up to me once and said, you know, the words white supremacy are really, I'm having a hard time with them. And I said, yeah, white supremacy is terrible, isn't it? And I just left it there. I didn't argue. I said, yeah, you're absolutely right. White supremacy is awful. And that's all I said. I'm not going to argue. I'm not arguing the earth is flat. I'm part of this system too. And it's terrible.
I was picturing walking up to a meditation teacher and saying, my mind was such a mess. How could you let my mind be such a mess? You know, because really focusing on that crying kid, of course I do, because I'm not, you know.
Exactly.
Just, yeah, right, right. And I remember Leslie Mack once on one of our shows and said something that I've just used ever since as a teaching tool, She said she uses defensiveness as a, like a bell, like, oh, look at this, you're defensive, you know? And that is such a, you know, that's such a nice reframe of when I feel myself going, you know, to go, oh, look at that. There's learning that can happen there because you just shut, you know? And so I think what y'all are saying about changing our expectations is so important, so that when things happen, instead of thinking there's a problem here that must be somebody's fault and who can I blame, we say, oh, look, we're on the path. This is we're where we need to be here, you know, and you know, just to see something as simple as Christina using a phrase, then saying, oh, that was ableist, and changing it, like how refreshing, instead of, you know, going into those pits that are on either side of that simplicity, right, that we all fall into. I'm like, oh no, now I've done it, you know, and just going, I did it again, I'll do it again tomorrow, and life goes on, you know. And of course that's easier said than done. I mean, the pain is real. And people do, I get hurt by people, I hurt people. That is part and parcel what we're doing with Aisha, which is why I'm excited that you're excited about this book, because I think we all could use some guides in those conversations that are helpful.
And one thing I would lift up, kind of coming, circling back to where Michael led us from, was also that this affects our communities of color and communities on the margins differently, right? So that when I'm teaching my children about how to express their emotions, I'm teaching them from a framework of real safety, not just comfort. Right. So I'm teaching them about comfort within the family of how to express themselves. But at the same time, I'm also giving them a parallel lesson of how, as young men of color, that they can express themselves safely out in the world. Because those are two very different things, like vastly different of how they can behave, you know, in our community of color versus how they can behave in, you know, a white dominant culture of, because it can get them killed. And so, you know, holding both of those, when we bring that into the congregational framework of making sure that we're also making space within our congregations of saying the way we all express this, isn't the same and can't be the same yet. And some of that, you know, we see in OWL where there's very different expectations sometimes around safety in communities. And so, you know, how do we reframe even OWL, which is one of our most, I hate to say valuable, but really like important resources, and how can we frame that even more for our youth of color? So just wanted to put that out there.
Well, and I think it's important also, Christina, to note that the way anger and sadness and these emotions are received when they come from people of color in our congregations is different too. And our congregations are not often safe spaces for those emotions coming from our members and colleagues of color. Just you all know that. I just think it's important to be explicit to the view audience world that this is part of what we're dealing with. And explicit. I just, you know, you kind of make
Clarity is our friend, Michael. I'm with you. And one of the things that the writer, there's another book I'm going to plug real quick. So You Want to Talk About Race by Ijeoma Oluo. And she was interviewed on Jordan Klepper. And she said she wants to put a moratorium on white people quoting MLK until they could do so responsibly. I want to put a moratorium on singing Building a New Way until we start doing it. So I thought, I'm like, you know what? Only certain people are allowed to sing Building a New Way, which just sounds so harsh. But part of me is like, but let's, you know, to sing it, then we really have to understand what we're singing and why. Now, obviously, I'm not going to put in moratoriums, because I don't have that power as much as I'd like it. But that's what occurred to me when I heard her say it. I'm like, oh, there's a bunch of things I'd put a moratorium on for you use.
Well, there would be a lot of songs we couldn't sing. Let's be real. Yeah. I mean, imagine if the songs we sang were not aspirational and they were accurate. A lot of them would
get
much flatter, much flatter.
Well, and one of the things that's sort of coming to me too, is just the idea that for, you know, white folks who are part of this dominant culture, that sometimes discomfort means you don't actually talk, you actually listen. Like, that's tough. You know, you got to kind of shut up and not maybe dominate.
Yep.
Okay. So now the white person will talk about that. I was just going to say, I see a lot of ministers my age, and I'm 62, really struggling to figure out what leadership means now, because it doesn't mean being the center of attention and talking all the time, you know, especially white men, but generally. And, you know, I've been saying to people, for me, in that regard, my years in youth ministry are very useful, because I was in my 30s and I knew how to shut up, you know. Like, so there, you know, there are models already for not taking center stage, but it's really interesting that some of my colleagues seem to feel that they are insulting in some kind of way, rather than, for me at this stage of leadership, helping out younger people feels like the main thing that I'm supposed to be doing. And I feel like we don't have models for how to be an elder minister that are not about me.
Lest we get angry emails from all the 62-year-old ministers in our association. As a 45-year-old minister, our colleagues my age are also struggling with that. So there, now we have two generations of ministers who can be angry at us.
Thank you.
Awesome.
We want to hear from all the boomers and the Gen Xers about how angry they are. Yeah. No, I think it's, you know, I think we're not talking about easy stuff, especially when it touches identities, whether they're identities related to oppression or identities related to privilege, that they're very personal for all of us. So that's why I think good practices are so critical, so that we can figure out how to be kind to one another. You know, I've been grateful that when I was young and doing some of the most publicly stupid things I've done, Twitter didn't exist. You know, nobody could film me on their phone and post it, because some of the things I did probably could have killed my ministry. You know, I mean, you know, I always did apologize later, but you know, I learned a lot by making really stupid mistakes, you know, and I wouldn't trade it for anything. I mean, I think sitting in a church basement till you don't learn not to make mistakes is just never going to happen, you know. Like, you got to get out there and interact with people,
and you're not going to grow if you don't make mistakes. Right. How does it work?
Yeah. How does it work? So I notice we're coming to the close. So I just want to say, any final words from anyone?
I would love for us to embrace humility. That's the other thing. We could do a whole nother show on how not a humble people we are. That's my final words. I need to learn humility too. I am not putting this on anyone else. I do too.
Anybody else? Last words. Okay. Well, next week we're going to have Wendy Von Courter come and talk about the complexities of civil discourse, One Congregation's Engagement, talking about some of the work that her congregation did that did land them in some hot water and what they did about it. And so that'll be kind of a continuation of this conversation in a lot of ways. It's been wonderful to see everybody again. I'm back for a while, no travel for a while, and I hope others are too. And see you next time, everybody.
This has been an episode of The View. If you would like to learn more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.